Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung.
Belgian fries or Belgian chocolate?
Definitely chocolate.
Perfection or improvisation?
I would love to say improvisation.
And is it light or shadow? What you prefer?
Shadow, because I did my master thesis about how shadows define space.
Designing light means defining perception through a combination of light properties. At the same time, light has many concepts, many characteristics, and many shades that need to be taken into account. This makes it complicated and simple at the same time, at least for Sabine de Schutter and her team, whose focus is on creating meaningful spaces that have a positive impact on people's lives. In their work, they combine functionality with beauty, creating an atmosphere that shapes the perception of a space, technically adept, minimalistic, and in harmony with the architectural style. On the one hand, they take a holistic approach, designing the perception of a space and its mood before selecting the appropriate luminaires. Or the other way around, where existing components wait for a new purpose in the sense of circular construction. Hashtag creativity is currency is the studio's motto. In our podcast, we, Katrina Patrice Varga and Eva Hermann, ask Sabine de Schutter how she implements this claim in her projects.
And it's time for a short introduction. The Belgian lighting designer Sabine de Schutter founded her Berlin-based office Studio de Schutter to provide lighting consultancy services from the creative planning of artificial lighting to daylight optimization. Sabine teaches architectural lighting design at the Wismar University of Applied Science and design innovation at the Hasso-Plattner Institute. Sabine, hello and welcome to our Jung Architecture Talks podcast. Nice to have you with us.
Hello, nice to be here.
So, like many lighting designers, you have a background in architecture. Was there a particular project that sparked your passion for light?
Yes and no. I think the idea of going into architecture, first of all, was something that I think I decided around the age of 12. That through a visit to a project of Victor Horta, which is a Belgian architect that is famous for his Art Nouveau style. And at the same time, besides his architecture, the light in the space is also very special. So I think it really was always a combination of how do I capture this atmosphere? And in the beginning, not knowing that lighting design could be a study.
So at the age of 12, so it's really a young age.
Yes, I was at the Waldorfschule, a Steiner school, as one would say. So I think the affinity to architecture was there. There were lots of my friends whose parents were architects. My parents, they come from photography, so their light is definitely a thing. We often had to pose as kids, me and my brother, in like certain areas because the lighting was good. I think so this kind of awareness of light and architecture was there. And then you have this idea of when you grow up, you want to do certain things. With me, the developed into creating a pitch actually for Polly Pocket, which was back then this, I don't know, toy, some early 90s that many people played with. And I sketched a boat. I think I want to have a Polly Pocket boat something. So I drew it in like plans and how I had seen how architectural plans look like. And I submitted it, but I never got any return on my first pitch, so to say.
But you can say architecture and lighting is in your DNA.
Yeah, well, I think yes, somehow it's something that I was made aware of like early on. And then again, I think life isn't linear. Through like some study options, I decided then for architecture and a little later at my university, it was like first 1 year of architecture altogether. And then you could choose if you wanted to further broaden the scope to go more direction architecture and urban or direction interior. And then I went for a master's in interior architecture because I thought, yeah, the element of repurposing and reusing, remodeling existing buildings, I really liked. So when we're speaking about the study and interior, the scope or the size, the scale of the projects were pretty big. My final project was then remodeling a historical urban landscape in the harbor in Antwerp, which was historical dry docks where the boats would go in, and refurbishing that to a theater. So if you say like interior architecture, many people think of like a very small scale. With us, it was the other way around. And it also had light, of course. And during the course of the program, there were many like turning points. One definitely was also a workshop in lighting, in which, again, I took that module because my friends from my Erasmus were there that I did in Spain. So again, like I would say, some coincidences brought me back to the track of lighting.
Sabine, on your website, it says designing light means defining perception through a combination of light properties. What does the art of designing light actually mean to you? Or also referring to the combination of light properties, what does that express?
We like to take a holistic approach. And with holistic, I mean like light. We were seeing lighting designers, many people think we're only focusing on artificial lighting and then forgetting the entire beauty of daylight. And in a sense, I would even go that all artificial lighting is trying to mimic daylight. All the good lighting, the good sources and how they dim and how they're flicker free and how they turn warm. At the same time, many designers don't incorporate daylight enough. So I think like as a lighting designer, we want to do both. You know, there is so much power in this combination of the two. I don't think they have to fight against each other. And then when speaking about artificial lighting, many people reduce it to only lux and brightness. And it's way more than that. Light, there's shadow, there's always a negative, there's a light color, there's a tone, there's a border to light. I don't know how deep I should go, but yes, I did my thesis about shadows. And then later, of course, in Wismar about how shadow defines space and how actually we should incorporate this knowledge on shadow in our work as lighting designers, and that it's probably wrong to only measure light. We're only measuring light the whole time, and we're basically blinded by the light in a sense by only looking to that. So that statement is basically an invitation to also like architects and other people say, hey, lighting is not just lux, it is way more than that.
Yeah, I always say that light and architecture is actually the most wonderful dependency because the one does not work without the other. My basic profession is also lighting design, actually. So I really know what you're talking about. And it's very interesting that you wrote your thesis about shadow. The power of shadow is forgotten in many, many projects and many approaches.
Yeah. And at the same time, I think like sometimes we get pictures from clients that can't really pinpoint why the lighting is not working or why a certain atmosphere is off. And it really helps observing the shadow. Looking at the shadow, you can learn so much from it. How are the sources? Where are the sources? Are they diffuse? Are they crisp? Are they direct? How do they overlap? There's a lot of knowledge into that and creating shadow-free environments. I mean, we're speaking here in a day and age where we're so much on the computer and in video calls. We don't want to have shadows on our face or glasses that cause shadows, all of these kind of things where shadow can be negative. And then again, light can also be negative in certain sense. So we're blinded by light. We often only focus on the light and we forget this whole like dependency and the effect. And we shouldn't just like place luminaires, but really think how does a space feel and how is a space influenced by lighting?
So light and also shadow is immaterial and cannot be experienced like a smartphone or a pencil or something like haptical or acoustical. On the other hand, it has an enormous impact. So why is lighting design always in the last episodes of a project? Why is it not at the starting point included with the architecture?
Yeah, I'm not saying that's always in the end, but often it gets forgotten. It gets forgotten because, as you mentioned, it is immaterial. We don't see it. It's often regarded as like a technical aspect of making a building function. And, oh yeah, by the way, we need lighting. I would say it's often on the line of like furniture, maybe. Oh yeah, luminaires and furniture. In the end, you maybe can choose a certain fixture. Then if the outlets are already there, you're starting from a compromise. There's not much more that you can change is changing the building. If you really want to create an impact with lighting, you need to start really from the beginning and look at where is the daylight? Where do we need to compensate with artificial lighting? How can maybe the daylight openings be chosen to remove or add daylight? We look at them in terms of like materiality and consult architects. I want to say of like certain elements. Is it opaque? Is it translucent? What are the reflection values? It's like the whole visual element of a project. And if that is left to the end, there's only very little you can do. I just had a talk the other day with somebody who mentioned a project in a basement, like a high-end retail space. It's on a prominent location in the city, but it is in the basement. How do you create awareness? You know, you can do this, of course, with signs and advertisement, but when doing architecture, right? And here I'm deliberately saying architecture because it's architecture and lighting. You can do way more. And I'm thinking of one of our projects, the Big Tam Tam that we recently finished in Hamburg. It's also a project that is in a basement in a shopping mall hidden from the street in the center of Hamburg. If the architecture wouldn't be that it rises from the basement to the first floor, and the lighting is there to support this element, and, you know, like it has to collaborate. We have to have these visions in the beginning because otherwise, yeah, you can have a sign that says, hey, there is something. But from the start, you can do so much more.
So it's a bit of decoration, also responsible for the atmosphere and also had a functional part. So where do you find the balance between all these different approaches?
Our approach is always to start with an analysis of the space. What is needed? What are the wishes? Definitely also what is the vision of the architect. But in this analysis, we look at the daylight aspect. Again, we're thinking of spaces, how they work in like summer or in winter. You know, the daylight aspect is entirely different. So again, referring to this project, Le Big Tam Tam, we're speaking about a shopping mall in the basement. How do you get people there in summer? Right? It's underneath a big bright dome, yes, but that doesn't illuminate the entire space. In summer, we need to have artificial light that compensates way more the daylight because the daylight is so bright than, for example, in winter. In winter, then again, we need much warmer light. So the functional aspect and the atmospheric aspect, I wouldn't say like it's so clearly cut. I see it as very fluid elements or different components about the lighting and in the end also then the programming of the lighting scene. Because there's not one light that fits for maybe one function, but then one function and one time a day, you know. Otherwise, light is always moving. Daylight is always moving.
What I also find very interesting in working with light is there's not one perfect solution. It can be either that or that, and the one is not worse than the other or better than the other. It's just like what you perceive and how you want to feel and live or work with light.
Yeah, absolutely. Perception is very individual. We've had very different clients, from clients who definitely do not want to meet the norms. Norms is, again, it's a generalization for a big part of the population. It doesn't say that we need to meet a certain norm, depending on the function, if it's in an office or if it's a public space. Yes, we need to cater to the bright scope of people. But in offices, for example, you're often encountering divergent teams. There are people who better work in darkness, have more focus because of it. They like to work more at night. Why put them on their 500 or 750 lux? And then you have other people who really want it to feel energetic, can see better. So yeah, there's no perfect light for like lots of people at the same time. And I'm even speaking about a work function.
Yeah, exactly. We found another really interesting offer on your website, actually, a lighting ABC. This ABC includes the term perceptual psychology. What does that mean?
We started with the ABC because there are a lot of terms in terms of like lighting and technology. And then a lot of words we use, we as lighting designers, that, yeah, aren't communicated so often. So that's how we started. And yeah, perceptual psychology, to come back to that, is like how basically lighting can influence how we perceive things and see things. Lighting can be very manipulative as well, where it's manipulating you is definitely in the supermarket, how it can make fruit and veg look fresher or fish fresher, more silver. And there are all of these tricks actually within lighting to optimize a certain perception of an element. And lighting influences how we see and what we perceive.
And you also had an interesting exhibition. It was called, in German, Das neugierige Licht. So maybe translated curious light. So what did you learn from the playful search for new light solutions, referring to your further work?
Ah, very interesting digging you did. The neugieriges Licht, I don't know, maybe I have to disappoint you, but that never came to existence. It was a very interesting and also ambitious idea of some lighting designers and lighting architects, but also people who produce more and different realms of lighting. We wanted to do an exhibition together, but that was in during Corona, so that couldn't take place. But the ideas were there. The group is somehow loosely still connected, but we're remaining curious.
I just wanted to ask, if you would do it this year, would you change the program?
Oh, I think yes, because I feel like so many things have changed within the lighting. I think what we all would exhibit would be different.
We see that circularity in architecture and design is a hot topic at the moment. Applied to you, Sabine, sustainable lighting concepts and circularity lighting, the reusability of components in lighting design. How do you plan and build circularly with light?
To plan circular and sustainable is something that the building industry is moving towards. We know that so much of the waste in our landfills comes from building, and yeah, a lot of waste is generated that we can't continue like that. Also in terms of like luminaire production and all the technical components, we've gone from very simple light bulbs that just have like 3-4 components to very complex, almost computers. Now a light source LED and it has a driver and consists of chips and all of that. And yes, on the one hand, we have a longer lifetime, but the cradle to cradle aspect from the fixtures should also be taken into account. When LED first started, everybody was asking, hey, how do you change the bulb and how can you do this? But now many years later, we know LED is there to stick. It's a good light source. It's a more efficient light source. It definitely had certain hiccups and quality issues. But now, how can we make it even better than it is? Because on the one hand, we have efficient lighting, which is lumen per watt. Again, something that many people focus on. But what happens once these people, I'm thinking of a restaurant or a hotel, what if the business doesn't work anymore? We live in a time with a lot of change, a lot of offices have downsized. Where do those luminaires go? What do we do with those fixtures? Can we repurpose them? And to repurpose a light fixture, you need to think not only of like changing the light source, which is not easy. There are certain certificates now coming to the market and certain manufacturers who are aware of this, and they are building elements that are more modular. And like as lighting designers and designers in general, I see it as our task to specify products that are well thought through, that think about the circularity, and also in our design that we think modular, that we think of elements that can be dismantled from the start. Like in our design, we're thinking about that instead of glued or integrated, I don't know, in plaster. We need to think of components, and I'm thinking of the light fixture and then the components within that. Can the driver be changed? What driver could it be in the long run? Can the reflector be changed? What if it's used somewhere else? Again, referring to a project of ours, we thought the user in the space might change pretty frequently. And we also know that people have an affinity to a certain color of light. Some people like to work more on a colder, brighter 4000 Kelvin light, and others like to have it way more cozy, like 2700 Kelvin, which is otherwise considered as like a warmer white. And so we planned in fixtures that have this ability to change the chip easily. And I'm saying easily, but on a technical aspect, it's not so easy because often the manufacturers don't allow end users to do this. I see it as a responsibility of a designer to plan in this aspect of sustainability, longevity, and then eventually circularity, even if it's not directly wished from a client, like it might not be in the initial brief, but I believe we have there this responsibility, and there's no client has ever said, oh no, stop, I really don't want to do anything that is good. They often like question, but if they see that this is an add-on and price-wise and delivery times, if that all fits, then that's a win-win.
In terms of new business models, I was thinking about Philips. The lighting industry is further ahead than the rest of the construction industry. They had this claim, lighting as a service. Is this an interesting point?
Light as a service, I believe it has an opportunity in certain areas, and I'm thinking of more functional areas where you need to reach a certain norm. I'm thinking maybe of a city or just like a normal street where norms need to be reached, uniformity, lux levels. Offices could be a space as well, although I feel there is already the element of comfort is an office more important. I see light as a service in logistic spaces, in streets and spaces like that. Schools maybe as well, where the maintenance is a thing, where lighting is very standard. Otherwise, I see it a little critical that everything would become too similar. Then we would be in a very unified world where lighting is maybe not adding character anymore. And we want to have spaces that are unique. You know, you don't want to go to a certain restaurant if it looks the same as the other, then you're kind of like almost going to a chain. So I think light as a service takes away some of the creative potential in projects. The project where we've considered it, we look at the break-even point, the financial feasibility, and then it's mainly about saving on maintenance or projects that you know they won't exist longer than 4 years. There it would make sense. Pop-up shops, pop-up offices, small expansions, those things. There it has good potential.
So for the listeners, it was developed for the airport Schiphol in Amsterdam for maintenance reasons. But it's very interesting because it's reinventing the way we are thinking about the construction industry.
Yeah, Philips has been very successful there with bringing LED and therefore more efficient lighting to cities on a big scale, where otherwise the investment would have been probably too big. And now there are, of course, many who copy that business model.
So to switch from the business model back to design and back to inspiration, you teach architectural lighting design at the University of Wismar and design innovation at the Hasso-Plattner Institute. So we all know the Hasso-Plattner Institute for the design thinking. So what do you transfer from the design thinking into your everyday professional life?
So much. It's very inspiring. Like I would say the level of understanding and looking at a brief has entirely changed through design thinking, where otherwise we would take a brief on a client and probably our technical expertise. We now look at emotional, social, functional aspects of lighting, saying also, how does it represent maybe a company and bringing an identity to a space? I don't know, like it's whole this research and the interviewing aspect of design thinking, the user-centeredness of it, through the methodology that I've learned at HPE, I've definitely been able to leverage some inspiration from the clients that I otherwise wouldn't have. One example is we frequently ask our clients about their pain points in lighting, and it's very interesting the feedback you get. And then suddenly people start elaborating and starting to speak very passionately, positive and negative in terms of lighting. So you get a whole other insight in their needs and not just from a purely functional cost time perspective. And then the other thing, what I would also highly advise to take up from design thinking is the idea that everything after the interview is basically a prototype. We start prototyping and testing, and this might mean sketches, this might mean AutoCAD and 3D models, but lighting is very subjective. Everybody experiences lighting differently. Is it cold or is it warm? Is it bright? Is it dark? Is it glary or not? So we incorporate a lot of testing in our process. So in our projects, we would go with rough models. We've got a studio full of lighting equipment. So we make quick mockups to kind of show this is how we would do it. And with that, we can brainstorm in the project together with the architects and try to have different solutions. We don't want to just hang lighting, let's say. We want to create something new. Sometimes that means also not following, let's say, the classical norms in terms of like, hey, this is office luminaire and we hang that in an office. No, we look at other ways to create visual comfort. So reducing the glare, maybe with fabric or different things instead of otherwise certified luminaires.
Unfortunately, we're actually at the end of our podcast, but to conclude our recording, we have one final personal question, Sabine. Now, I think you're going to be surprised about our research again. In a TED Talk, you talked about your fascination for unconventional solutions that break the rules and create new rules at the same time. Is there any current building you would like to rewrite the rules for?
A building that recently inspired me a lot is the library in Helsinki. I really loved how it combined daylight with artificial lighting, how it brought nature into the space and the entire flow, how it was very open to the public. I think that is probably a building that I would say is rewriting the way I'm going to approach certain projects.
Thank you very much, Sabine. We will all go to Helsinki and watch the new library to see or feel the same. It has been a great journey of inspiration with you. So it's time to say goodbye from us until the next episode of the Jung Talks Jung Architecture Podcast.